Welcome to the 360 Justice Podcast, where criminal justice leaders talk about how they are solving tough social infrastructure issues like aging facilities, insufficient funding, inadequate staffing, and an ever-changing political climate. Here's your host, Eli Gage.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 360 Justice Podcast. I'm your host, Eli Gage, and I'm joined today with my co-host and friend, Ken McGinnis. Ken was the former director in both Illinois and Michigan, and is now a senior vice president with CGL. So, Ken, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
And we're really pleased today to have Gary Moore with us. Gary is the past president of the American Correctional Association and the former director of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. So, Gary, thank you for making time for us.
That's great. And thanks for emphasizing the rehabilitation. I like that, Eli, a lot in the title.
Well, it's funny you would say that, because I wanted to ask both of you about that. Some states incorporate that into the title. Some other states don't. What is your all's stance or feeling about that?
I think very few states do. Ken, at one point, I thought it was like four or five. I may be wrong, probably wrong on that. But I think it goes back to my first year, I think, is director with John Kasich in 2011, I think that was the first time every single director in the United States of America, not a stand-in, but every actual director met in D.C. and discussed our role. And the outcome of those two or three days in D.C. was that our focus is actually to reduce recidivism. And I think prior to that, the directors, you know, if you looked at mission statements, it was typical good security, safe, you know, secure public safety, which is all good. But it didn't go, I think, far enough for the public expenditure money, right? So I really think that starting in January of 11, with that meeting, there was a shift in the philosophy of our directors in the country to say, we've got a real stake in ensuring that we reduce the future crime victims in this country by the people that we are supervising. So I think it was that, but the name changes didn't follow that, Eli or Ken.
Yeah, I think the issue in most states, not that they don't agree with the concept of including rehabilitation in the title, was once you open up the statutes for change, most of those titles are set by statute. And it just opens up the door for a lot of things you just don't want to get into. So most people have just held pat.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's obviously, Gary, I know it's near and dear to your heart, but it says a lot in the statement, I think.
Well, Eli, one of the neat things I had the opportunity to do as a director was I met every single new employee, and we had about 12,500 employees, their first hour of employment with our system. I traveled to our training academy, and I spoke with them an hour. They had to endure me for an hour. But I talked about our vision and mission, and our mission statement was simply to reduce recidivism among those we touch in our prisons and on parole and community. And I talked about why, and pretty passionately. And I went back to my origin in 1974, starting as a teacher, actually teacher's aide at the Marion Correctional Institution, and talked about how impactful we could be and we can be to public safety based on what we do with those under our supervision and how we communicate and work with them, and that we play a huge role. And I spent an hour with them, and while some didn't agree, and hopefully we weeded them out during the training period, but every single person, all 12,500 employees, knew our entire mission statement, which was that one phrase.
Let me switch gears a little bit, Gary. And I know you and I talked recently, and you can tell us what you can tell us about ACA, but I do want to touch on that because the American Correctional Association is such a big part of our industry. And over the last year, during which you were the president of ACA, was a wartime president, I suppose, of the ACA. Can you give us kind of a state of the state of where things are?
You know, I served 2 years. And as I started my first year, I had all kind of vision of traveling the country and traveling all of the local state agencies and doing all of these kind of things. That ended after my first year. You know, actually, you know, the American Correctional Association was established in 1870, and 2020 was our 150th anniversary. And I'm personally attached to the fact that our very first president of ACA was the governor of Ohio, Rutherford B. Hayes, who accepted that based on the urging of his wife, who ironically grew up in my town where I lived, Chillicothe, Ohio, Lucy Webb Hayes. Unbelievable connection here. So I was so excited, and our summer Congress was going to be in Cincinnati where we were established. It was going to be the largest Congress we ever had, and it was going to have a total focus on our members. Total focus. Going to be a totally different event. Well, I got canceled, right? Got canceled, but killed me. And then our winter conference was all virtual, and I was absolutely the only person that traveled to Alexandria to Virginia to be part of this virtual Congress. So while my visibility kind of dissipated from the public view of ACA, every day I was on the phone with the staff at ACA because of the financial. Yeah, think about this. We're able to receive a significant income from our summer Congress and from other, you know, accreditation trips and those kinds of things. And not having that, our revenue stream was challenged. We had to deal with some staffing issues, although we did get the PPE. There were just a number of things. So every day I was on the phone with Jim Gondels and the staff, sometimes four and five times a day during the entire year. But that was kind of invisible. And it certainly wasn't anticipated by me. But the state, I want to just say the state of ACA is strong. And I commend the ACA staff. We were one of the only organizations in the United States that actually had pandemic insurance to cover our summer Congress, which was significant and huge. And I give credit to the staff for thinking, you can't get it now. You can't get pandemic insurance now for these things. But they did. And it was huge. And let me just also say, during this time of strife, we pushed accreditation, even though we couldn't in most states go into the systems, but we talked about the value of accreditation. And during the 2 years of my presidency, 5 states or 10% of the states in the country got back into accreditation that were not in before. So the future, I think, is bright. And I think ACA, the staff did a tremendous job of developing materials, tangible materials for the COVID issue, brochures, pamphlets. They did webinars where actually thousands of people were on these webinars dealing with best practices, dealing with COVID environments of prisons for both staff and inmates. So presidents don't do a whole lot with ACA, to be honest. I mean, it's the staff. I mean, you're there, you're on the sideline cheering them on, right? And pushing and then things. They did a wonderful job during this, and ACA is going to come out, I think, very strong. And by golly, we're going to meet in Nashville in August, and we are going to physically meet. And I think people will look forward to that. And we'll probably also, Eli and Ken, incorporate some of the virtual aspects that we learned so much about in our winter conference. So that'll be kind of enhanced as well. But by golly, we're going to get together.
That's great. I was curious. I think I did hear that Nashville would be a live event again. So that's encouraging. I know that the certainly the vendor community relied on it very heavily. Yeah. And I think we all did. CLA always meets there, and it was a big void for us, I know. And I think that this would have been my 60th ACA show. For the last 30 years going to ACA. I mean, I've gone twice a year, every year. And I know it kind of freed up my summer and certainly freed up the winter a little bit, but I'm looking forward to going back.
Well, Eli, you guys have been very prominent at ACA, not just in the vendor hall, but in presentations and in, you know, the standards committees. And, you know, you just have been very, very hands-on with ACA. And I know ACA appreciates that.
Thanks, Gary. you want to talk about the recruitment and retention? Because I know that was a big emphasis for you at the beginning of your term.
Yeah.
It's a problem all over the country, obviously.
Well, and I'll be anxious to hear Ken's perspective on this. And I have a perspective. First of all, let me just say this. Staffing and retention was a significant, I think the most significant problem and challenge to systems before COVID. You know, I did work in states and I just cited some things. I went to North Carolina after 5 staff were murdered at the end of 2017, when was asked to support their reform there. And their state had a statewide average of 23% vacancy. Well, that's somewhat misleading because some facilities were at 8 or 9%. So you had some facilities on the extreme that were really challenged to function at all. And that was not specifically North Carolina. I went to another state where they had bordering Ohio that had parole officers standing security posts in prisons or in an urban prison because their vacancy rate was 43%. You know, there was a northern state that closed a high security prison and transferred high security inmates to an absolute southern state in this country because, one, high security prisons took more staff to supervise, and they didn't have the staff. And that was the first time in my 47 years of this work that I can ever remember a prison moving inmates out of state because they didn't have any staff. So this was all pre-COVID. So, and COVID certainly, you know, expanded, you know, that issue. But let me just get to the point here. There are a lot of things, and I do want to get into it. There are a lot of tangible things I think need to be addressed. But the number one thing in my mind is the public image of our correctional staff. I've gone through in 47 years, tens of thousands of incident reports, not just in Ohio, but in other states that I've been in. And I want to tell you that there is not another law enforcement group in this country that responds to more incidents that could result in loss of life than our correctional employees in our prisons and our jails. There's none. And yet, I'm driving through North Carolina or I'm driving through any state and I hear these advertisements about specials for first responders, car dealerships, all these special offerings for first responders, and very seldom are our correctional staff included. I believe, I've written, I've said it publicly in speeches, I'll say it here today. I believe if you look at the pay of our correctional staff, if you look at the vacancy rate of our correctional staff, if you look at the uncertainty when they report to work, whether they're going to be relieved to go home and see their family because of staff coming in, when you look at the incidents that they respond to, more incidents that could result in loss of life than anyone else, I believe they're the greatest public servants of our time. And I know that's controversial. And right now, I thank God that we have recognized our nurses and our delivery people and our grocery workers and all of those folks that do such a great job for us, but left out our correctional staff. And I think based on all those reasons, I consider them the greatest public servants of our time. Until our public starts recognizing and respecting what our correctional staff do, no one will aspire to be a correctional employee. I mean, they are critically looked down upon. They're looked at, you know, often as the lowest rung in the ladder of our law enforcement professionals. That should not be the case. I believe that the public sentiment has a lot to do with people aspiring to do this because we do not, as a society in our country, respect our correctional staff the way they should. I think there's some other tangible things that quite frankly should be done. Think about this. We know studies, I studied this significantly in North Carolina when we were doing the reform, but it's true everywhere. Turnover is highest in the first 6 months of employment. And that makes some sense, right? Sometimes people get into work and they say, man, this isn't for me. And they get out, and that makes sense. But those first new employees are coming into a system, they typically are the first ones to be called into overtime. They're the first ones to be mandated either to come into overtime or mandated to stay another shift based on lack of seniority. So our new employees that are coming in are most adversely affected by the vacancy rates, which perpetuates this significant turnover that we're seeing in our systems. I think that's a big issue. And I think some systems, I think this is another thing that should be studied more intensely, is that some systems have gone to 10, 12 hour shifts to help accommodate. They've done an analytical assessment and said, well, you know, we can get by with a few less staff if we go to two shifts, these 12 hour shifts or whatever. And we really have not studied the impact of that. And I can tell you, and you guys know, the pressures responding to incidents, responding to those things, a 12-hour shift is a long time. And then even after 12 hours, in some cases, people are not relieved to go home. And that is most affecting those new employees with lack of seniority. So I just really think that we need to be looking at these 8-hour shifts. I think we need to be looking at some break for these new employees so that they are not significantly and always maintained. And then finally, and I hope we get into this too, we've got too many people locked up in this country in prisons. And I know that COVID has had a significant reduction. I'm concerned about what's going to happen post-COVID with our prison populations. But I think the lack of staffing may actually continue to drive our population down because we're not going to be able to staff our prisons. And that's also a need for your work in terms of technology so we can reduce the manual task of counting and those kinds of things. I would love to lift up in the minds of anyone, in the hearts of anyone that's listening, an element of respect for our correctional staff. I think that is foundational to our profession and foundational to ensuring we have enough and the right people doing a very difficult job.
Gary, it's kind of interesting when you look back, and you've been around as long as I have, is, you know, when I hired on, they were only hiring people with advanced degrees. That's how selective they were.
Yeah.
And then when I came to Michigan in 90, a correctional officer had to have at least a year of college to be hired. And people were fighting for these jobs
right
up until the mid-90s. And then all of a sudden, things have changed. And whether that's because of change in salaries, benefits, competition, because of full employment, I do agree with you. The number one issue is solving this recruitment retention issue, because it puts everything at risk in a correctional environment.
Ken, you kind of opened up a window for me a bit. I started July 1st, 1974. Let's go back to that time and think about the impact. At that time, Ohio had 8,400 people incarcerated in its prisons, 8,400. And I believe there were 9 prisons at that time. When I assumed my role as director, now we were able to reduce the population some, not nearly enough, but we had 51,000 people in Ohio's prison. We, during my career, my life, and I don't think I'm that old, I know other people do, but I don't. During my career, we went from 8,400 people in 9 prisons to over 51,000. So the demands of our correctional staff, and then, you know, the increase of wellness and treatment, et cetera, the demands in Ohio's population, state population has only marginally increased in that 47 years. So, and the crime rate has not increased. So our public response to behavior has shifted almost to a default prison culture. I hope it's digging out of that right now, Ken. I hope it is. You know, there's enough emphasis. In fact, I'm doing a little work in the state of Michigan right now on some legislation that hopefully will do a few things. But the point is that, you know, you can't increase anything over 500% in a state where the human beings that live in that state have not significantly increased without, I think, starting to create some challenges with staffing. And you know, Ken, in the 90s, Ohio started put up some metal buildings, right? In the late 80s and 90s that were temporary housing that are still there, still housing people, because the growth was so great and the expansion was so great in that time. So, I think our response to criminal justice, heavily relying on prisons as an anchor without any increased staff resources, have really kind of challenged this whole issue of making sure we have enough and right staff.
Gary, you mentioned, you started to talk about COVID, and I've asked this of several people, you know, during the last 12 to 14 months, you know, there's been tremendous challenges to everybody in corrections, and a lot of changes have been made, both to the criminal justice system, correctional practices, correctional facilities. As we come out of it, what kind of things do you think are going to sustain itself and last and become permanent?
I'm hoping, you know, I think the prison population has been most significantly impacted, because I think a number of systems have just said, we're not taking anyone from jails. And then the court dockets have slowed. So I think once that starts to ramp up, I hope that we still have some lingering effects of a reduced number of people coming to prisons. I don't know that that's going to be the case or not. I think it will. I think, Ken, as many things do, I think budgets will drive. I know that as budgets, state budgets shrink, it does force people to start thinking about how to spend money. And prisons are expensive. You know, I was looking at the Washington State Policy Journal, and I think it was 2017, I think, and they did a wonderful piece on programs, cost of correctional programs, and it looked at all different kinds of community programs and compared the cost and the rehabilitative value of those programs compared to incarceration. And what they fundamentally found, as we know, is that community corrections was twice as effective at one-third the cost of prisons. And I know, and Ken, you know, as a former director, we're both former directors, prisons are not good for some people. Now, prisons need to be in place, but for some people, we do some damage. At least I did. Maybe Ohio's the only one, but I did some damage. You know, think about this, Ken. The fastest growing group of people in our prisons in Ohio and in the country are women. And the women, I can talk in detail about the characteristics of women versus men in Ohio. Women had a higher rate, according to Texas Christian TCU's instrument on substance use, had a higher rate of substance use, had a higher rate, significantly higher rate of mental illness, and their offenses were significantly less violent. And yet that is our most, that is a group of people that are the highest, the largest increasing group of people in prisons. I almost don't even know where I started with this, but I'm hoping that we start looking at science and research and what works with certain groups of people, and that budgets, ironically, may force us to make more selective decisions. And let me say one other thing here while I'm connected to this. You know, our budgets are segregated, right? We have a state budget. We have county budgets. We have criminal justice within the state. We have criminal justice. We have mental health. We have all these separate budgets. And yet, the people that we need to take care of, the people at risk or the people that are in the criminal justice system, are often have the same characteristics. And yet we segregate our funding, and then we segregate and separate the type of sanctions, jails, prisons, or for the criminal justice folk, or community corrections for criminal justice. And then those people, these grandmas and like me, grandpas or parents, that may have a child that they believe has an addiction issue and they're thinking, well, what do I do? Well, we're spending money on the criminal justice folks over here. You know, we have another pool of money over here. I think we have to think bigger. And my belief is we need to move the pool of money earlier in people's lives to more effectively address this. And Ken, I don't believe right now that we have the types of facilities and the types of sanctions and treatments that are holistic that are most responsive to that. Because I think our individual budgets, we start separating those out and they then end up in separate types of facilities and treatment programs, et cetera. So I really think it's time to rethink this. And post-COVID, I would hope would do that. Although, doggone it, Ken, we're so partisan, and even our state legislators, that we have a tough time thinking thoughtfully and strategically in private sector in your business. That's what you'd be doing. You'd be thinking strategically. And I think I would love to see a real think tank rethink our responses to not just criminal justice, but addiction and people at risk that eventually may fall into that, and to think about how we can best respond to them.
You opened up something I was very interested in when you were during your tenure in Ohio. You spent a lot of time and resources, and we were involved in at least a part of it, in trying to develop what the future of the facilities were going to look like, and preparing for changes in providing treatment programs, changing in restricted housing. Could you talk a little bit about why that was important to you?
I love this. And I can tell you, I can remember the day, and I think we're down at the Orient Complex there at Pickaway, and there were seemed like 100 people in the room, I think. And I slid into the back of the room. I slid into the back of the room when we're talking about this. And I uncharacteristically just listened for about an hour or so. And then I started thinking, I said, you know, we know this. We know that getting a GED reduces a person's risk to recidivate by over 20% and reduces their propensity for violence in prison by almost 20%. And Ed Latessa was in our prisons looking at every program and looking at violence reduction and reduction in recidivism. So we know all these things. We know that substance use programs do this. We know that therapeutic types of programs do this. We know mental health, all of these things do this. And yet, how do we operate a prison? Well, we count people 8 times a day, right? And every time we count someone, you know, we come to a standstill. And in reality, and you know, I don't mind saying this publicly because should be a calling for change. We tend to be positively engaged with the inmate population maybe 4.5 hours a day after you take meals and counts everything. So as we think about what we're doing, if there's a value in programming, if it demonstrates an evidentiary value there, if it reduces future crime victims in the community, if that's true, and I believe it is, and I believe the evidence is there, then we should be designing facilities that maximizes that kind of engagement and doesn't diminish it just because we've done counts that way for 100 years. So I think that, and I also believe, I believe in the automated count system, you know, but I believe in that a lot. I believe in having residential units. You know, I did a study, asked for a study to be done in Ohio on recidivism by prison, right? And we gathered people that, and we set standards like, well, the person had to be spend at least 70% of their incarceration period of time in that prison. So we had all kind of research help me with all these kind of factors. But we found out that the Allen Correctional Institution had the lowest recidivism rate of any prison we had in Ohio. So, and it was a medium security prison, and it was built in the kind of new generation prisons. So what made it different? You know, I would be scorched if I went to a lecture to talk about this based on my lack of foundation. But what I know to be true is this: the Allen Correctional Institution had the most specialized housing units for the longest periods of time. Almost everyone at that prison fit into a specialized housing unit, whether it be for substance use, whether it be for mentally ill, whether it be we had people that were struggling with below average IQs. We had specialty units. So what happened is not just that they were together and not just that the program was delivered in the unit. And as you know, it kind of discussion continues after the program, but staff were assigned to that unit, became focused and centered around that topic. And I believe that had a huge and significant impact on the quality of that prison. Not just that the inmates were together, but the staff started to gather an interest and expertise and continued that kind of programming because they were all kind of housed together. So as you remember those discussions, I was very focused on kind of specialized housing, even to the point that if we could dine in the housing units, it would be great. And that the time of staff engagement with their clients or inmates should be expanded, and we should reduce the manual kinds of things like counts that disrupt that. So you either believe in the research and you start to shift the direction based on that, or you're anchored to 100 years of practice. And I believe that so much, and I still believe that this is a time to really rethink that. So I guess, Ken, I do get pretty passionate about that because I don't think our practitioners and your profession have collectively thought about this in a broader thought pattern than an individual prison. I mean, I think it would be wonderful to engage an energetic team to look at the future, because I think the future looks different than what we're doing now.
Going back real quick, your thought about public image with the correctional officers, and you know, we have frontline workers in our facility management division that during COVID were going into these facilities every day without never stopping. So we feel kind of the same passion for that frontline worker that you do. But this public image of our industry right now, whether it be the correctional officers themselves or the industry as a whole, without getting into all the spotlights on our industry, you know, maybe even including privatization, where does that effort come from? Is that a job for ACA?
It absolutely is. And I didn't mention, we launched an initiative with the Bureau of Justice Assistance. We received a grant to identify, and it was all around staff wellness, number one, as well as promoting our staff as first responders. So ACA is in the process, and they've gone around and identified what individual sites are doing and publicizing that. And there will be actually a publication coming out from that effort. But beyond that, as a warden, you know, I should have been doing more of this. But, you know, it's getting out in these darn churches and communities and talking about this. And as I said in my ending speech as president of ACA, I challenged every correctional professional. Every time we hear our correction staff being rejected as great public servants and first responders, we need to stand up and respond to that. We just don't come to the defense of corrections the way we should. And if we don't do it as practitioners who know what's going on, it's not going to get done. And I know this is a long-term issue to start to shift the image of corrections, but we've got to do it somehow. And, you know, I was pretty disappointed. I wrote an article about our correctional staff being the greatest public servants of our time, and I sent it widespread to media sources, and I didn't see, I saw a couple of minor articles. It was published in Corrections Today, but I think we have to be the instruments of that change. Eli, you said the word. We think sometimes our lives are long, right? You know, long life, et cetera. But we're just here an extraordinarily short period of time, just as kind of a speck, so to speak. And if we don't get up every day and focus on what's important and be motivated to change where change is needed, if we don't do that every day, then our life passes. And that's why I think I'm, you know, and you get 47 years and, you know, how many more years you have. But every day I get up and I think about pushing buttons. You know, I don't write papers to have them acceptance. Oh, that's great stuff. I write things to challenge people and to start to get some debate. And debate is what we need. And I think it's this, you know, this meeting, Ken, that we had in Ohio that I remember with these 100 people and me drifting into the end of the meeting. And I stood up and it was pretty dramatic, I think, in my comments about how we need to really rethink things. You know, we need more of that. And, you know, I would hope that in some small way, people that would listen to this podcast would think maybe this time for some sort of gathering that really can have some life expectancy beyond a gathering, and really think through these issues. And, you know, think about this, guys, from your perspective. States get money to do some capital work, right? And, you know, they're all psyched and focused and everything, and it's a small slice of pie. Those states don't have the perspective that you have. I mean, they really don't. And it's not their fault. I mean, they've lived their life here. We really need to lift up, just like we have in the research in terms of evidence-based programs in prisons, we need to lift up best practices, some of the European work that you have seen, and lift that up and pose that to systems to say, you know, maybe we need to think about doing some piloting of this. You know, when we continue to build, you know, Ken brought up the issue of restrictive housing. We've set standards in ACA that talk about programming, that talk about step downs, to talk about all of these kind of things. Well, we need to follow that practice with a form that will support that. You know, we can't talk about a psychologist having an interaction, a professional interaction with a person that's in restrictive housing if there's no place for them to talk. And until we get there, then management needs to find ways to move them out. And we need, let me just say this too. We build restrictive housing units, right? And if you're assigned to that unit, you're in restrictive housing. That paradigm needs to change. These paradigm shifts need to really take place if, in fact, we need to do this. And then we need to engage our staff to say, we're not putting you at risk. We're not putting you at risk. We're actually reducing the risk of violence based on what we're doing here. And we're going to demonstrate it based on evidence. So, man, I would love to, I would love this podcast to somehow be inclusive of a lot of folk and have a lot of interaction almost on an ongoing basis, Eli, to think about where does the best practices and evidence tell us we ought to be going? And this group would kind of chart a path to get there. And I'm not sure that exists right now, Eli. I don't know that it does. I know it does in isolated and individual elements like you guys, but I don't know that there's a collective movement to talk about that.
People seem to have their heads down in our industry right now, which is sad to me.
Well, you know, listen, when the governor changes in your state, you don't change doctors. I mean, your doctor's your professional that you go to, that you consider to be the person that is most helpful to you. But, you know, every 4 or 8 years, we change. And the continuity is not there. Think of, you know, you think about Gonzaga's basketball team, 22 years with Mark Few at the head, and how every year they're just a really good program, that continuity, and he doesn't have to go out and recruit, people come to him. Well, we change, and the people that are appointed feel they have to appease the person that appoints them. I guess correctional chiefs are not maybe viewed as professional as much as they are somewhat political. And then every time a new director comes in, there's a feeling that you have to change something, right? A warden changes the color of a wall, right? That's what happens in a prison. Directors change policy. So we don't have that kind of continuity. And I don't think we have fully embraced the Dr. Ed Lattesa's, the researchers that are saying, hey, you ought to be doing it. Think about, I want to just, I had to get this out because I find this fascinating. Pepperdine did a great study. Pepperdine University did a great study on people that were returned for technical violations. And what they found was that their return to jail, the amount of time they spent in jail had no bearing on whether or not they would go out and commit another offense. And they started to study it like from 90 days and then to 30 days to 50. So you could actually go from 90 days to 10 days and there was no difference in behavior. So the swift, certain, and fair philosophy started to take place. Well, there's some pretty hard research to that effect. And yet, you know, we don't seem to follow it. And I just saw a recent research piece in Ohio that follows the national research. It said that two people that commit similar offenses, one doesn't have the resources, so stays in jail until their court hearing. One has the resources to be released into the community. Those two people who commit the same offense, the person that's coming from jail has a higher percentage of being convicted, and if convicted, has a higher length of sentence than a person coming from the community, even though they've done the same things. And as long as that decision is based on money and not risk, it's one of the most fundamental issues with human rights I've seen. And it's expensive, and it just creates this. Now, listen, I believe we will always have prisons and need prisons. I believe it. It's a public safety issue. I think we have overused it. And I go back to what I said. It's astounding to me. I would love to have someone explain to me how we can go from 8,400 to 51,000 without a significant increase in population, without a significant increase in crime, and be happy about spending all of that money after a criminal event and not wanting to push those resources earlier in life so that we can perhaps save a life. We didn't even get into collateral consequences, but in many cases, even misdemeanors in some cases are life sentences, but with the ongoing collateral consequences that go on. So it's time for reform. It truly is significantly the time for reform. And maybe the budget issue coming out of COVID might be an impetus to look at that.
Let me ask Ken a question. Because Ken, unlike probably you and I, Gary, although it sounds like you're staying quite busy, Ken goes all over the country doing this great work that he does. Ken, what do you feel like the appetite for, as Gary calls it, a paradigm shift? How do you feel that appetite is?
Well, I agree with Gary. I think the impetus for change in state government is usually budgetary. You can talk philosophy all you want, but when it comes down to the bite in the bullet, I think dollars are going to drive change. And, you know, in the 80s and 90s, there was this huge movement to divert, reduce recidivism. I mean, this is not a new thing we're talking about here. This has been going on since the 80s, and it was all because of budgetary restraints, as people realized they couldn't build their way out of the situation to the degree they'd done in the 80s. because of the operating costs. And I think people are searching for solutions, not only to the social issue of use of prisons, but also to the budgetary impact of use of prisons. And I think the opportunity exists right now to rethink what a prison is, to rethink how they're structured, how they're built, and how they're operated, and then what the outcomes are. And I think, as Gary's pointed out repeatedly, there's a lot of data out there that says there's effective ways of doing it different that we're not utilizing. So I think there's an opportunity right now to do that. Gary, one issue we just touched on briefly, which become to the forefront just recently because of presidential action, is the issue of privatization.
Yeah.
You have the unique background of working on both sides.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what your feeling on that. I mean, I think there's good and bad in everything we do, but this has become a hot button issue.
This could go a long time, but I'll try to make my comments focused, because there's some very clear thoughts about this. Private prisons, when someone starts to talk about private prisons, it's like it's stereotyping, quite frankly. I think they need to go to the agency. Listen, the agency is the organization that directs policy, that directs the contract, that monitors the behavior, that sets the expectations, that deals with how inclusive they will be with that private partner. It's the agency. And I will just say this, and we, you know, in Ohio, in 1999, a law was passed that mandated that at least two Ohio prisons be privatized. When I became director in 2011, I was known as the private guy, right? I spent 38 years in the public sector, the private guy. But the reality was, when I left, we still only had two private prisons. We didn't have any more. But here's the deal. I don't believe there has to be an operational difference between a private and a public prison. I don't believe that. I believe it's how it's managed. I believe that if you put a full-time monitor in these prisons and you write the contract and the policies are exactly the same, that you have the same type of aggressive internal monitoring every year with a numerical score that's more aggressive than the ACA audit process. And on the other side, if you are inclusive, if the private wardens are at every warden's meeting, if your deputy wardens are at every deputy warden's meeting, if you include them, so you can learn from them as well, because there are some lessons to be learned here, particularly in some cases with employee incentives that the state doesn't offer. But if you can do that, I believe private facilities can operate as well as public facilities, and the data in Ohio demonstrates that. At least when I was there, the aggressive internal management data demonstrated that our private facilities were operating as well, in some cases better than some public operated facilities, and that level of competition can be used to lift up the performance of everyone. The systems that fail are systems that have a contract, that monitor, but maybe not monitor as much, that don't require the same policies that the state has, and don't include them in meetings to talk about why we're doing things and be inclusive. Those systems, I think, tend to have private facilities that do not perform as well as their public facilities. But I think the focus is on the public agencies handling of those and not the private sector performance. I believe that. And I will always believe that, Ken, based on my experience with that. And then finally, I did work literally with a private sector company as the director of organizational development and staffing, as well as a consultant. And I never had as much freedom in my life to create initiatives and best practices than I did when I was in the private sector.
Interesting.
Well, guys, I want to be respectful of your time, although I think this has definitely got me thinking that a part two may be in order with you, Gary.
Well, let me just say this, Eli. So one of the thoughts we're going to do is, what does Gary Moore do next? And I do have, I get more correctional website, LLC. I do some things, and I'm working on some legislative things as well as working with some other folks. But what I've realized after this hour, I just want to travel around with Ken. That's what I want to do in my future. So now I know what I want to do. So you've kind of made my vision clearer in the future. So, but I appreciate it. It's been a fast paced and enjoyable hour.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time, Gary, and Ken, thank you for your time as well. You know, Gary, if you travel around with Ken, he sustains himself on a diet of Diet Cokes and Twinkies.
I saw the Diet Coke. I didn't see the Twink. I saw the Diet Coke behind here, but hey, there are worse things, Ken.
There absolutely are worse things.
Are you in North Carolina still?
No, I'm back in Ohio. We still live in Chillicothe most of the time, although we've had a residence at Sunset Beach, North Carolina for about 18 years.
Well, good. I'm hoping that you'd be willing to come back to the summit.
I think so. And so, Eli, it has been great. And I really appreciate Ken being on the line. I didn't give him nearly enough time to chat, but it was a pleasure. And I being here and having Ken, you know, once you're in the seat of a director, it can be pretty lonely. And you remember those feelings after you leave. And just being able to engage with another director is, I think, therapeutic. And it's enjoyable. So I wish you guys well. And I respect you. I respect you personally and your company a great deal for your openness and focus on the customer and your thought about the future and what the future holds and how you can contribute to that. So I value that a lot. And I appreciate you asking me to be on today.
Well, we appreciate your time. And
thanks again. Guys. We'll see.
Right now. Well, having done several of these podcasts now, that was great stuff with Gary Moore, and I particularly enjoyed the director-to-director conversation. So thanks, everyone, for listening to our podcast today. You can find this and other episodes on all the standard podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify, or you can visit us at cglcompanies.com/podcast. If you have suggestions for topics that you'd like to hear covered over the next year, please reach out to us at podcast@cglcompanies.com. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the 360 Justice Podcast. To see today's show notes and relevant resources related to today's topic, or to make suggestions on future topics and guests for our show, visit our podcast page at www.cglcompanies.com.